Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma. I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jim Henderson, who's Director of Energy Transition at the OIS. Now, for the month of October 2022, we're doing something a bit different. The OIS is running a series of podcasts focused on COP27 and the issues that are likely to be faced at the conference that is being held between the 6th and the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Each podcast will consist of a number of interviews with authors of the articles in the OIS Oxford Energy Forum number 33, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. This is going to be published in October 2022. David and myself will both be doing the interviews, and we hope you enjoy listening to them.
This third podcast will again focus on the challenges that will be faced by three major regions at COP27. We're talking to Isabel Hilton about China, Sarah Ladislaw about the USA, and Klaus-Dieter Borchardt on Europe. Now we are welcoming Isabel Hilton to the podcast, and she's going to talk about her article in the OEF, China's Climate Strategy. Isabel, welcome. Great to have you here. Now, how is Chinese environmental policy developing in 2022 ahead of the 20th Party Congress in November?
Well, it's great to be here, David. And of course, we're all looking at the impacts of the 20th Party Congress. But I have to say, in terms of climate and environment, we don't expect any major upsets or any major changes. The direction, the longer term direction has been set for some years. And in the shorter term, the five-year plan, which was agreed last year, has set the targets and it set the ambition for China's climate and energy strategy, for its environmental ambition for the next 5 years. What the Party Congress will do is to, I suppose, reaffirm control of the political apparatus that is in charge of delivering that five-year plan. I don't expect it to upset the five-year plan particularly. Certainly, you know, we've seen in the past year, we've seen the sectoral plans coming out. So each industry will have a plan. This is what happens with five-year plans, that the headlines get announced and then every sector of the economy has to work out how to implement it. And that's the process that we're in now.
Okay, so at COP26, China surprised everyone by agreeing to continue a dialogue with the US on environmental issues. However, my question is, has the Taiwan issue changed everything, or is there a hope that the talks might be rekindled at or before COP27?
We're not seeing a lot of hope for rekindling at the moment. It was a good moment in COP26 in that first week. It did lift everyone's spirits, and it had a number of elements: the setting up of a joint working group working on, for example, on methane release, and that really could have been extremely useful. But when Nancy Pelosi decided to visit Taiwan, a number of bilateral arrangements fell, and amongst them, as you say, the climate discussion. Now, that has been suspended, so in theory, it can be revived. And it will very much depend on how much leeway the leadership in the US and China feel that they have. Right now, we have Xi Jinping heading for a party congress. All focus is on that. We have Joe Biden heading into the midterms. So in both cases, they have very little room for maneuver, not least because of the nationalist discourse in both countries, which focuses on the other and narrows further the room for maneuver. So where would we find some hope? Well, it may be that after these two political events, the leaders feel that they have a little more leeway. I think it's unlikely to come before COP27, to be honest. But you might get some conversation between Xie Jianhua and John Kerry, who, after all, were the two who brokered the original COP26 arrangement. I was looking at what Xie Jianhua was saying in New York at the UN last week, and I have to say it's pretty tough. It's essentially calling out Western countries for failing to meet their obligations to the emerging economies on climate, on compensation, on loss and damage. So there isn't much sign there of any kind of olive branch or any hand extended. But, you know, perhaps behind the scenes there is a little more going on. I don't expect a big reversal before November, though.
One would hope so, I have to say. Coming back to kind of a more general question, you know, is the energy transition and climate change a priority for China in the short term? Or, you know, have other issues started to take precedence? You know, what about the goals for peaking emissions and reducing the use of coal, for example?
It's perhaps not as well understood as it should be that China's climate and environment goals are embedded into industrial strategy, and they have been for nearly a decade. So when China became the world's biggest emitter, it was a moment also when China's old industrial model was running out of steam. So the leadership identified two things: the threat of climate change to China and the opportunity, the industrial opportunity and technological opportunity that climate change represented if China was to bet the farm on low carbon technologies. And that's essentially what happened. So in one sense, that is completely unchanged by recent events. What, however, we will see some variation in is the speed of mitigation in China, of domestic reduction of emissions. Why? Because largely because of energy security concerns. So if you look at China's energy profile, what it has in abundance in China is coal. Everything else pretty much has to be imported. And the turbulence in the markets, first because of COVID and now because of the war in Ukraine and overall because of the US-China tensions, mean that if you're a planner in China, you have security very much on your mind. And that means that you hang on to coal. And the kind of conversation we're seeing around coal is really quite extraordinary. So, for example, coal being used as a capacity market. So when you have shocks to other forms of generation, as we saw in the summer, for example, in Sichuan, with the drought and the drop in hydropower, the idea is that coal could be kept in reserve and could be ramped up to meet those emergencies. So we're not going to see a reduction in coal capacity. We may see a reduction in coal use, depending on how quickly the renewables market does develop and depending on other factors like simply weather. But I don't think we're going to see an acceleration of mitigation either. But it will continue at a fairly steady pace. China has a lot to deal with right now, a sinking economy, certain amount of security issues, political security issues, as well as energy. So it's pretty much steady as you go.
Okay, well, can we perhaps finish by kind of looking at China's approach to the COP27 negotiations? You know, what are China's objectives, do you think? And do you think it will continue to take the role of leader of the developing world?
And China likes to present itself as leader of the developing world for a number of reasons. One, it means that it slightly evades responsibility for delivering a certain number of global goods like carbon reduction. It has pledged, as we know, carbon neutrality by 2060. But by championing the cause of the developing world, China can keep the focus on the failings of advanced economies, particularly the United States, and hope to avoid too much scrutiny of its own. And from the speeches that we've been hearing from China's leaders up till now, that's pretty much the tone that's being set. And I guess we will be looking too, given that COP27 is one that was, and it was anticipated, would see a big increase in ambition, what China will bring to the table on that. It's just not obvious. We haven't had any, you know, signs of a big announcement, but I guess there might be something. One of the things China did relatively recently was to launch its national carbon market, and it's counting on that to have quite an impact on its emissions. It isn't working yet, and there are a lot of holes in that carbon market. So perhaps there could be some adjustment there. But honestly, I don't expect a big ambition, and I do expect China to keep talking about the failings of the West.
Well, Isabel, you know, we've come to the end of the time. You know, thank you very much for your contribution to this podcast and also to the Oxford Energy Forum publication itself. We are now welcoming Sarah Ladislaw to the podcast, and she's going to talk about her article in the OEF, US Climate Policy and the Impact on COP27. Sarah, welcome. Now, The US played a key role at COP26, but many have been concerned about a lack of domestic progress on environmental issues. However, of course, the latest Inflation Reduction Act seems to have changed that. Can you perhaps tell us why it is so important?
Yes, thanks, David. It's a great question. So the United States has passed in the last 2 years three really important pieces of legislation. The first was the bipartisan infrastructure law, which was mostly focused on trillions of dollars of investment in domestic infrastructure, a good portion of that on the energy and climate space. Then a bill called the CHIPS and Science Act, which actually puts a lot of money into research and development in clean energy technologies. And then finally, this bill called the Inflation Reduction Act, which most people don't really associate with being a climate bill, which has about $370 billion worth of spending in tax incentives and programs to incentivize the development and deployment of clean energy technologies. About two-thirds of it is tax incentives, one-third is programmatic spending, and the bulk of emissions reductions enabled by this will come from the power sector, the transportation sector, but it also builds out clean energy, supply chain manufacturing, and decarbonization of the U.S. industrial base. So it is a big bill. It is three and a half times, if you add up those three bills, it's three and a half times what the U.S. spent in the Recovery Act following the 2008 financial crisis. It is impactful. It is supposed to, if fully realized, get the U.S. 80% of the way to its 2030 climate targets. So a billion ton bill is sort of, you know, what people are, a gigaton bill is kind of the way to think about this. And the other piece is it's really sophisticated. It doesn't just put a lot of tax incentives out there. It basically says, we want a good portion of the investment in clean energy to go to transitioning communities, low and marginal income communities. We want to make sure that we're building a clean energy supply chain in the United States. And we want to make sure that there's fair labor and wages involved in this bill. So it's a pretty remarkable piece of legislation, and combined that with all of the Biden administration's efforts, both domestically and internationally, I think it's the first real sign that the United States can do something very large towards meeting its targets.
Okay, so Sarah, I know, how important is state action versus federal action in progressing U.S. environmental policy?
Yeah, it's really important. We tend to focus on the federal policy piece, and that is certainly true because of the major federal action that we've seen so far. But it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, there's probably 20 to, you know, 23 states across the country that are also, you know, sort of laboratories of policy and investment when it comes to clean energy. And so we're seeing a lot of innovative policy and around not just emissions reduction goals, but also economic development, pollution reduction, all kinds of things that are designed to try and help states play a leading role in terms of showing the way the country can reach its decarbonization targets. I think it's important to note it's not just Democratic-led states or progressive states. There's also, you know, this really interesting phenomenon where renewable energy on a power generation side or even manufacturing of clean energy technology, often it happens in Republican-led states, right? Places where we don't think about the politics of climate change being, you know, being the driver, but instead just good sound economics, right? It makes sense. The resources, they're there. They want to make those investments. And so I think that when you look across the country, particularly now that we have all of these incentives that are going to be made available, both for clean energy technology and infrastructure, the way in which states lead in uptaking that those incentives and build that infrastructure and deploy those technologies is going to be really, really important. The second piece is because of all of these incentives, the cost of clean energy technology should come down, right? That's the objective in scaling the deployment of these technologies. And if that happens, it makes state leadership on regulation and climate policy much cheaper to enact. And so I think there's a very positive feedback loop that if we get all of this right, can be achieved between federal action and state action that continue to sort of, you know, get us the rest of the way towards our targets.
Okay, Sarah, so let's talk about the COP27 conference itself now. You know, what role do you think the US will play, and, you know, what will its key objectives be?
I think COP27, as everybody, you know, seems to recognize, is going to be really difficult. You know, the global environment is challenging right now. It is one of, you know, volatile and record high commodity prices. This is the first global energy security crisis that we've seen. It is probably going to be almost undoubtedly, you know, worse by the time that COP comes around. And quite frankly, you know, a lot of the near-term effects of that energy security crisis have meant that emissions are headed in the wrong direction. And the messages about, you know, what we need to do to provide short-term energy security versus the longer-term energy transition is only intensifying some of the tensions between developed and developing countries. Many of the developing countries, you know, feeling the worst of the impacts from this energy security crisis, plus the impacts of climate change, as we've seen in Pakistan and other places recently. And quite frankly, just not a lot of signs that the U.S. or other countries are going to be able to meet their financing pledges in a way that gives them, you know, surety that a sort of more resilient future is in the offing for them. And so I think in that, from that standpoint, one of the key objectives here is to try and figure out the most productive conversations that can be had at this COP. What can we, you know, do to reassure each other as nations that we're going to be able to make forward progress in this new context of, you know, the clean energy transition in the context of a energy security crisis. And I think that the U.S. is going to be trying to make sure that there's going to be elements where we can say we are making progress and there's progress happening, you know, in these ways, and we need to figure out new mechanisms for sort of emboldening that progress and continuing it.
Okay, so do you think that other concerns, you know, Russia, China, Middle East, will distract U.S. politicians, or is the environment such a core part of the U.S. agenda now? And also, of course, you know, what would happen if the Republicans return to power?
Yeah, what's really interesting to me, you know, and if you look at the Inflation Reduction Act or any of the major climate legislation that we've seen pass in the U.S., almost none of it is cast as climate legislation. Most of it is done for reasons of energy supply security, concerns about industrial competition with other countries, particularly China. And quite frankly, I think that because the energy security crisis has lasted this long, because it's come after a global pandemic that really challenged our notions of the interdependencies of, you know, of our economy, that actually we're in a fundamentally new phase now where we've realized that our energy system is inadequate to all of the challenges that we're facing, the energy security challenges, the climate challenges, the pandemic, supply chain challenges. It is just not doing the trick. And so I think it's almost bipartisan now that there needs to be a new way of thinking about, in particular, U.S. supply chain security and energy security, and that the clean energy transition is quite frankly going to have to be part of that because some of those technologies are just superior, right? They are what we need to have a more diversified and more resilient energy system. And so while I don't think that the climate part of that or the international climate part of that is necessarily completely adopted by Republican policymakers in the U.S., I do think that we're at a different stage now where there's a recognition that clean energy is the future of the energy system, and we need to be able to have new strategies for making a secure global energy system that heads in that direction.
Well, Sarah, you know, thank you so much for your contribution to this podcast and, of course, the OEF publication itself.
So we're now welcoming Klaus-Dieter Borkhardt, who's a senior energy advisor at Baker McKenzie, to the podcast. Klaus-Dieter has written an article for the Oxford Energy Forum around Europe's energy transition plans and their relationship to COP27. So Klaus-Dieter, welcome. And maybe I could just start with the question of the moment, if you like, is, you know, the Russia-Ukraine war has obviously caused a huge scramble for access to hydrocarbons ahead of the winter in the EU. Has this caused a big distraction away from the region's climate targets?
Undoubtedly, Jim, yes, it has. And you can see that the focus is now clearly on how to safeguard security of supply of energy for the coming winter and beyond. And if you look at what at EU level has been undertaken so far, you see a lot of legislative activities, regulation on gas storage targets, regulation on gas consumption reduction. Only recently now, last week, a regulation on electricity demand reduction, revenue cap on electricity, solidarity contribution by the gas, oil and refinery businesses, and even a general gas wholesale price cut is under discussion. And also at the member state level, if you look to the member state, you can see quite some diplomatic activities by the heads of states and governments and energy ministers. They'd like to strive deals, especially on LNG, but also on natural gas imports, and very often even in open competition between member states. But I would also like to stress here that this does not mean that the EU has given up on the implementation of the Green Deal and the achievement of its climate targets. This legislative work on the Green Deal measures are advancing well in the European Parliament, and I would say fairly well in the Council. And this also includes rather a positive discussion on the increase on the climate targets 2030 as proposed by the Commission in its Repower EU communication.
So you've touched on the Repower EU communication there. How have those plans reframed EU energy strategy in the light of the Russia-Ukraine war?
The Repower EU communication clearly outlines the pillars of EU actions for phasing out Russian gas. That's now decided, and this Repower EU plan involves a kind of, I would call it, a fundamental shift in the vision of the evolution of the European energy landscape. It relies on a fast implementation of all Green Deal legislative proposals, higher targets for renewable energy from 40% to 45%, and also higher targets for energy efficiency from 9% to 13%. And this to compensate a stronger and faster reduction in the EU gas consumption. Implementing this plan, the Commission relies mainly on three levers in order to phase out Russian gas: energy savings, diversification of energy import sources, and also a faster switch to clean non-fossil energy. And all these actions are underpinned also by targeted investment in infrastructure, new LNG terminals, you are seeing them everywhere, notably also in Germany, and also a major budget reform worth more than 300 billion euros.
Okay, but so when you look at the targets, both in the RePowerEU, but actually, you know, the overall, the energy transition targets, the emissions targets, the kind of renewable investment targets, are they realistic, especially for 2030? And if they're not, then how should they be rethought?
No, Jim. For me, these 2030 targets, especially in its increased form, are not realistic at all. Not only are these targets for the increase of renewable energy sources, so wind and solar mainly, too ambitious, but we also see now a very strong increase in LNG, natural gas, and even coal is coming forcefully back into the European energy mix. And what I expect is that in 2030, when the member states have to come up with their new national energy and climate plans, here we will then clearly see what the member states are ready to contribute in order to reach these targets. And I expect that we will see that these, in aggregation, what the member states are planning for measures, they will fall clearly short of the EU targets 2030. But will this lead to a complete rethinking of the 2030 targets? I don't think so. because for me, the targets are not the problem here. What is needed is are rather concrete measures that lead to an acceleration of the decarbonization process, aiming at an achievement of the 2030 targets, maybe not in 2030, but as soon as possible after, 5 or 8 years after. And if you would do that, I would not see any critical situation for the achievement of the 2050 target, which is a European Union reaching net zero carbon.
Okay, so as we head towards COP27 then, I mean, we've got a situation where you're saying that the 2030 targets are not realistic, albeit that doesn't necessarily mean we won't miss 2050 targets. But on some of the other interviews on the podcast we're doing ahead of COP27, we have representatives from the developing countries who've highlighted the point you've made that, you know, Europe in the short term, despite all its protestations about transition, is turning to hydrocarbons, to coal, is asking for more imports from non-Russian sources. Does the EU go to COP27 with any credibility, really? And what are its key objectives going to be this time around as opposed to COP26?
That's a very tricky question, I must say, because I do understand the feelings of some of the developing countries, as you have just described, that they feel that the EU is just playing around with the developing countries by saying you have to go out of fossil fuels, and at the same time, the EU is going around and begging for more imports of fossil fuel. In the light of this energy crisis. So I think that the EU, if they really do not want to lose the credibility or to strengthen even its stance in the global climate discussions, the EU must explain its strategy and has to show its determination, not only with regard to its own decarbonization pathway, but in my view, equally important also with regard to its readiness to help poorer countries with the achievement of theirs. And here it is important that the Commission, in my view, has to, or the EU, has to shift away from telling the poorer countries, the developing countries, that they have to go the same pathway, the same target setting pathway as the EU has done. I think it is more important that the EU should offer concrete partnerships involving the technical but also the financial assistance to all countries that are willing to live up to the global Paris Agreement target. And here, by concrete measures, concrete assistance, also, as I said, very important for the COP27, that the financial assistance is ready to achieve concrete results together with these countries, and not just telling them what they have to do, but based on an analysis, what is the right pathway for decarbonization for each of these partnership countries. In my view, that is what the EU now should do, and not only in a more abstract way tell those countries what kind of target setting that they have to do.
Okay, well, that's a very useful insight, I think, and I hope the EU do take your advice at COP27, because clearly there's an issue to be addressed, both short-term and long-term. But Klaus-Dieter, thank you very much for your answers to the questions, and also for your excellent article in the Oxford Energy Forum, which will be out during October. But for the meantime, thank you very much indeed. We would like to thank all our interviewees for their time and their excellent contributions to the October 2022 edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.